And welcome back to Coast, Charles Cockle with us. His book is called The Equations of Life, How Physics Shapes Evolution. And we're going to come back and talk more with him and take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Charles Cockle with us. We are back with him, and we're going to take your calls this half hour as we continue chatting with him about all things space. How did you get interested in astrobiology, Charles?
I've always been interested in space, and for some reason also just biology. When I was young, I used to collect moths, and I was just fascinated by natural history. But space exploration was also something I was interested in. So throughout my life, I've had this this interest in linking biology and natural history with space exploration. And when I finished my doctorate in the UK, I was really lucky, and partly through some persistence, to get a postdoctoral position, which is a sort of scientific research position at the NASA Ames Research Center in California. So I went and lived in Northern California for 5 years and worked for NASA. And that was the time when NASA set up the Astrobiology Institute. And astrobiology was really getting going. You may remember the Martian meteorite that was thought to have evidence of Martian life.
Yes.
And Bill Clinton was out on the White House lawn. And it really, you know, this really brought attention to astrobiology, and that was the time, I think, when whatever you think about the meteorite, it really spurred on astrobiology. And I was lucky to be at NASA at that time. And other places around the world were also now beginning to think about doing astrobiology. So I was able to sort of indulge my interests in biology and space sciences in a professional way, and now I am, you know, 20 years on from that postdoc, a professor of astrobiology, and it's become a really mainstream subject in universities around the world.
Well, it's amazing work that you've done, Charles. A great book, by the way, The Equations of Life. Let's take some calls. Let's go to Tom in the Bronx to get us started. Thomas, go ahead.
I'd like to say that these monster asteroids that pass the Earth and some hit the Earth, it's my thinking that some of these asteroids, if they're really solid, would come down with the impact and hit different areas of the Earth and make maybe continents or islands submerge into the water and make other continents rise. Some of them may put a lot of dust in the air, and they claim that the dust may have caused the dinosaurs to unable to breathe with the dust in the air. It choked them to death. And that's what do you think, sir?
Yeah, I think that's you raise a really good point. We're not just an isolated planet with life on the Earth just going about its business. We live in the space environment, and that means that every now and again, as you say, asteroids and comets collide with the Earth. And we know they can do pretty dramatic things. 66 million years ago, there's really good evidence that an asteroid struck the Earth and, just like you said, lofted dust into the atmosphere, and it would have cut out sunlight and stopped plants from growing, and the dinosaurs and many other creatures would have run out of food. Once the plants are gone, there's no food for herbivores to eat the plants, and then the carnivores have got no food. So the whole food chain collapses. So we know that an asteroid big enough can cause a lot of disruption on the Earth and maybe even change the direction of evolution. So I think you make a really excellent point, which is that life on Earth, evolution, is not just an isolated thing happening on a planet disconnected with the rest of space. We very much live in the space environment, and we're influenced by it, and asteroids are one of the things that has influenced life on Earth, and we should probably think about them and worry about them ourselves as a civilization. If we want to stop ourselves from going extinct at the hands of an asteroid, they're good things to think about. Yeah.
All right, next up, let's go to Paul in Rome, Georgia. Hey, Paul, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Good morning. Excellent show, as always, Mr. Moore.
Thank you, sir.
I wanted to ask you just what he thinks about two things, about the idea of the panspermia, and also that 98% or over 98% of our DNA is considered non-codable or junk DNA. Could that be, have different types of humans in there or whatever? Thank you very much for taking the answer.
Sure thing.
Yep, both great questions. So the panspermia, this is the idea that, that life could be transferred from one planet to another. If you have a, going back to the asteroids, if you have an asteroid hit the Earth, it throws up bits of rocks, and we know that rocks have lots of microbes and bacteria in. Could those rocks have been thrown out into space and eventually drifted to other planets? It's a really interesting question. People have done studies on whether microbes can survive being hit by an asteroid, and they can do. They can survive in bits of rock, and we know that some bits of rock can be hurled fast enough into space to leave the Earth's gravity. In fact, we have Martian meteorites on the Earth that that originally came from Mars. So we know that the planets are exchanging rocks. Why not exchange life? Well, we don't know. And if we do ever find life on Mars, it may not be surprising if it turned out to be related to life on Earth. And in fact, if microbes have been exchanged between both planets, maybe we share a biological ecosystem. That's pure speculation at the current time, but panspermia, this idea that, that life can be moved from one planet to another, is a really intriguing idea. It has a lot of support for it. We just haven't yet found another planet with life in our solar system to really test the idea. But if we, as I say, if we do find life on Mars, we need to consider, could it have come from the Earth? Or even vice versa. Maybe we came from Mars. Maybe we're all Martians, as some people like to say. So that's the first part. The other part, question you asked, was all this DNA we have that, that seems to be junk DNA. Yeah, that's also another interesting thing. Is it just DNA that we used to use early on in our evolutionary history, and it's just been literally turned into junk, and now it's not useful? Or could it be useful? I think some people still wonder whether junk DNA is really junk DNA, or whether we just don't yet know what it's for. There's a real possibility that as we get to know more about human genetics, we'll find that some of this so-called junk DNA is actually up to something and is part of our biology. Some of it may well be genes from our past biological history, you know, genes going back to our time as reptiles and fish. I'm not saying we can still become reptiles and fish, but some of that junk DNA may be a legacy of our evolutionary past. So you can see that we still have a lot to learn about the genetics and DNA, even of ourselves, let alone the rest of life on Earth.
What do you think of the multiverse theory, Charles?
Yeah, I'm not really enough of a cosmologist to profoundly offer an explanation or have a view on that. I think it's, a really fascinating idea. Why is it? I mean, one reason why people thought up the multiverse is that why is it that all the laws of physics in our universe seem so fine-tuned for life? And, of course, you can argue, well, they have to be fine-tuned for life because otherwise we wouldn't be here to observe the universe. But then the question is, but still, why are those rules aligned in that way? And one possibility is that there are lots of different universes with different physical laws, and we're in the one where the rules are good for life because we have to be, otherwise we wouldn't be able to observe them. But there are these other multiverses out there. Again, I don't know enough about the cosmology to understand the technicalities of it and to be able to say whether it's true or not, but it is one of the most exciting ideas, I think, in recent cosmology that does bear on the idea of life and the significance of life in the universe.
All right, back to the calls again we go. Let's go to Kim in Casper, Wyoming. Welcome to the show. Hi, Kim. Go ahead.
Well, thanks for taking my call. Very interesting show tonight. I appreciate it, guys.
Thank you.
Well, I have a theory that, Earth is in that golden zone of life. And when I was 11, I had a dream where Mars used to be in that golden zone. Now Earth is there, and then Venus will, in fact, be next. And not necessarily human life, but life. Just want to see your opinion on it.
Yeah, this is a really interesting thing. So you're talking about what some people call the habitable zone or the Goldilocks zone, right? That zone around a star where conditions are just right for life. And here on the Earth, if you get too close to the sun, the oceans all boil away and you get a runaway greenhouse effect, and you end up with Venus, a boiling hell of a world. And then if you get too far out, it's too cold, and your atmosphere begins to condense, and you end up with a cold planet. And you're absolutely right. In fact, your dream is not completely off, because Mars is sort of in the habitable zone. It's right on the edge there. And we know that in its early history, it had liquid water. So the Curiosity, NASA's Curiosity rover, is right now studying sediments in ancient lakes. So we know that Mars was suitable for liquid water. So in some sense, it's right at the edge of that habitable zone. It's just a little bit too cold now, and the water is also frozen out of the atmosphere, has disappeared. Venus is another interesting thing. I think it won't become more habitable because it's already a searing, as I say, a searing hot world, but it may have been cooler in its past. The sun has been increasing in luminosity over time, and we know that because we can observe other sun-like stars at different stages of their lives. And we know that the sun was about 30% less hot, less luminous than it is today. And so in the early solar system, Venus would not have been a runaway hot planet. It could have been a lot cooler. And some people even think that for the first few hundred million years of our solar system, Venus could even have had oceans. And those oceans eventually boiled away and it became the planet we know today, which has a thick carbon dioxide atmosphere that makes it hot. So your dream is a good dream, because actually it's all about how the habitable zone changes over time, and planets can come in and out of that habitable zone, go from being able to support life to not supporting life, or maybe even going from not supporting life to supporting life. Some people think that Saturn's moon Titan, which is a frozen cold moon with an atmosphere in orbit around Saturn, will one day warm up and could even become slightly Earth-like. Maybe one day we'll all go and live on Titan. So maybe one day you'll have a dream about even planets further out in the solar system becoming suitable for life, and one day it may even become real.
You said earlier that you got interested in all of this with catching moths.
Yeah, that's right. I had an interest in moths when I was young. Moths are interesting things. I won't go on too much about them. They're very sensitive to changes in their environment. They're very fussy about what they eat, and you can use them as indicators for environmental change. That wasn't what I was thinking when I was young. I just had an interest in moths. But as I got older, I saw that these things, moths and butterflies, are actually really useful environmental indicators of the health of environments. I ended up moving on to microbes in my professional career. I didn't really collect moths these days, but up to my teens, I was a really keen moth and butterfly amateur scientist.
What if moths are also caterpillars in the beginning, right?
Yeah, that's right. They're caterpillars, and then they undergo this metamorphosis, and then they turn into moths or butterflies. It's itself a remarkable biological process.
Can you tell the difference between a moth caterpillar and a butterfly caterpillar?
You can do. It's a bit like, it's probably a bad analogy, but it's a bit like stamp collecting. You know, if you study these things a lot, you get to know the caterpillars. And certainly when I was young, I was very good at identifying caterpillars and telling you which moths and butterflies they would turn into. I think I've forgotten much of that knowledge there, but a good entomologist, someone who studies these things professionally, can tell you by looking at a caterpillar whether it's a moth or a butterfly.
I like the Citheronia moth caterpillar. Is that the one with the spikes?
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, some of them are remarkable. Some of them have spikes. Some of them have really, really gaudy colors. Some of them have these huge sort of enlarged heads. Caterpillars come in incredible varieties, like the adult butterflies and moths, I should say, as well. I mean, right the way throughout their lifespan, butterflies and moths from eggs through to adults have this amazing variety. I mean, going back to the equations of life, butterflies and moths are a perfect example of how they conform to the laws of physics, because they have to fly so that the wings are adapted to allow them to fly through the atmosphere. Yet within that constraint, you can still have this amazing diversity.
Let's go to Michael in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hello, George, and hello, Charles. Charles, spell your last name for me, please.
C-O-C-K-E-L-L, Michael. C-O-C-K-E-L-L.
Thank you very much. Charles, the most famous atheist, one of the most famous atheists in the world, was a microbiologist all of his professional life, until he got deep into the study of the DNA molecule. His last name is spelled B-E-H-E, and his first name is Michael. Michael Fahey introduced the concept of irreducible complexity with regard to the DNA molecule. And apparently he is among a group of microbiologists who convinced Bill Gates that evolution could not have occurred. So I think, to use a phrase coined by former governor of Minnesota, Jesse Ventura, I think the sound bite kind of news media is preventing us from making progress, and only the Art Bells and George Norris of the world are going to allow mankind to advance. Now, what the evolutionists have done over the years is convince several popes that they must adopt a medium theory called evolutionary creation. In other words, they have conceded the evolutionary argument, which I think endangers the Roman Catholic Church with extinction, because I believe that irreducible complexity advanced by Michael Fahey is going to win the argument with people who have an attention span capable of listening to a program like Coast to Coast AM. We are the survival of the fittest group that will render all other groups extinct.
Well, we are unique, Michael, that's for sure. Charles, don't you think?
Yeah, this is, I mean, you raised some really good points. I think there's a basic point of principle behind this, and that is, and I would go back to the need for human humility. So we talk about irreducible complexity. There are many things that we don't understand, and the job of a scientist is to try and reach some sort of truth, or at least to try and grapple with some sort of truth using evidence and experimentation and observations. There's a lot that we don't know, and it's really wrong to be dogmatic. I mean, I happen to believe that the process of evolution actually does explain biological complexity on the Earth, but not in a dogmatic way. I'm a scientist and willing to listen to any other ideas. If people have other suggestions about how this process works, even if they believe that a creator is involved, that's absolutely fine. That's a perfectly good thing to discuss. But it's obviously important that whatever idea you have, you need to be able to bring to the table some sort of evidence that mechanism can explain biology. And no scientist ever claims to know the truth. We try and find the truth, but we don't claim to know the truth. There's a really important distinction between those two things. Science is always on a quest to find the truth, but it never claims to know the truth. In fact, science works by constantly criticizing what we know. So the idea of irreducible complexity, something that's so irreducible that you have to bring in the idea of a God, I don't refute that. I simply say that if you do think that, then you need to provide some basis for thinking that. I think that the things we don't understand in evolution do not at the current time require us to say, well, that must be a God. I think we can accept the fact we don't know things yet, and by continued research, we may know those things. I'm not yet willing to concede that we must introduce a creator.
Not at this point. Charles, thank you for being on the program, The Equations of Life. Up next, we're going to the International Space Station. Come along. The International Space Station started in 1998 and is expected to operate until 2028. 14 years ago, I had the amazing opportunity to talk to astronauts aboard the ISS.
Alpha, this is Houston. Are you ready for the event?
Houston, this is Alpha. We are ready for the event.
Premier Radio Network, this is Houston. Please call Alpha for a voice check.
Alpha, this is George Norrie, host of Coast to Coast AM on the Premier Radio Network. How do you hear me?
George, we hear you loud and clear. This is Michael Foe, commander on the International Space Station, and Alexander Kaleri, the flight engineer.
Well, Michael and Alexander, it's good to talk with you here down on planet Earth. Let me ask you, first of all, you're up there 250 miles above the planet. Are you able to pinpoint anything on the planet? Can you see, for example, the pyramids whenever you circle the globe?
The pyramids are only just visible if you know where to look and you have a pair of binoculars. Another feature I have tried to look for is the Great Wall in China. That also is extremely difficult to pick out because it's of the same color as the background. Much easier features are things like cities or, of course, dams and reservoirs.
I'm really interested in your feelings, you, Michael, and you also, Alexander, when you have that ability to look out into the universe, look down at the planet. And, of course, to some of us here on planet Earth, we don't have that awe feeling yet because we don't have the ability to be up there in space. But what is it like, just as a human being, to be up there?
It is a unique sensation. Speaking for myself, one feels very fortunate, lucky. It's like being on top of a mountaintop or a hillside where you have a great view. It's a new perspective, and it makes one, if you're a thoughtful person, reflect on where you've come from, on the people that have helped you get here, especially, and on where humanity is going.
Alexander, let me ask you, if I can, tell me now, how long have you been up there in the International Space Station?
I cannot remember exactly. It seems me for about 4 months, maybe 120, 25 or 30 days. I'm not sure.
For you, Alexander, and also for you, Michael, your requirements for your day-to-day operations up there in the ISS, generally, what does your day consist of? Let's start with you first, Michael.
On a regular basis, we get up at, we're meant to be getting up at 6 and be at work by 8. Breakfast, toilet, all those things are things we have to accomplish here the same as we would on Earth. Once we get into the workday, the days vary enormously from one day to the next. One day we might be doing quite a lot of work on laptops and computers, monitoring instruments that are already running that we have set up or were set up by people before us. And that's a fairly passive, keyboard-intensive task. Other days we could be fixing large pieces of equipment with wrenches and have the whole place torn up and have things floating around us and be doing an enormous amount of machine shop type work. And on another day, we might be getting spacesuits ready to take experiments outside and establish them on the outside of the space station. So our days are very varied, and it's sometimes hard to predict what the next week will be like.
Alexander, how do you keep your mind occupied within these projects? Many people on this planet, of course, get bored very quickly just by doing things here. What's it like in the International Space Station on a day-to-day basis, really, to keep yourself occupied, to keep your mind occupied?
Если я правильно понял вопрос, то у нас тоже тут иногда...
We also sometimes have very monotonous work tasks, but usually it's very varied. Sometimes it gets a little bit boring and routine gets us down, but sometimes it's very interesting, and usually the alteration of such work keeps us from getting really bored. I believe that we're at the top of a huge pyramid, at the bottom of which a lot of people are relying on us or expecting from us fruitful work, and this also helps us pull ourselves together. And sometimes there are very interesting grains of experiments and works that compensate for everything has been accumulated before, probably some negative emotions or something like that. So we keep ourselves fit by different means.
Alexander, a few weeks ago during the spacewalk, your space outfit began to fill up with water. Your helmet began to get wet. What was that like? I mean, did you know at that time what was going on?
Well, я
I was able to understand that something was going on that was not supposed to. I felt quite well. At the moment, it was not yet clear what was going on and how it was going to be occurring at the time. At that particular moment, the situation was quite stable, but since we didn't know the reason of that anomaly, and we did not know if a drastic deterioration of the spacesuit was going to happen, that was the reason why the management of our flight decided to cut it short and to bring us back to the station, since we achieved our major goals and stop our work at that point, and look after we took off the spacesuits, what the reason was. After we looked at the cause, it became clear that at that time during the EVA, the situation would not have been deteriorating too greatly. We would have been able to continue working, but it was already thinking back into the situation. It didn't do any damage to either the program or to my health or to the tasks of the EVA.
Mike, these have been some very tense times, and at the same time, enlightening times, I think, to be aboard the International Space Station. In the past few months, of course, you had a small object sound that hit the space station. You then had a air leak that you and Alexander had to fix. Are there tense times aboard the ISS where sometimes you're concerned about your safety and the safety of Alexander?
Not in an acute sense. I would say we certainly haven't experienced any events of an acute nature. There are nagging worries where you know that if you let your guard down or you become sloppy in your work, everyday work, in paying attention to maintaining the safe standards of the space station, then you would endanger either your lives or the people who come after you. So we have to be on our guard, carry out our jobs properly and completely, reporting all the discrepancies. Because of the number of backups or different ways we can overcome our problems that might arise, for example, leaks or other things of that nature, always I know that if we have this kind of steady methodology and we approach these things in a progressive way, we can always work them out and work around them with the ground. And that has been the case over this expedition. So that's what I rest on. I basically know that if I pay attention to detail and I follow these things carefully, we will remain safe. And that's been the case to date.
Mike, when the space station is finally completed, it's going to be bigger than a football field. What percent is completed at this point?
That is a very hard question to answer, because I personally cannot imagine the full football field even being up here. We have windows only in certain directions, and actually looking up away from the Earth, or away from to the top of the station, as we would call it, it's rather hard to view it. So to imagine how big all those arrays will look is actually a little difficult for us. Nonetheless, just from what I know about the space station, I think in terms of hardware, we're of the order of 60% complete. But that's a very rough guess. Also, the space station is an international project and open-ended to some extent. There are a number of Russian modules that I know have been designed and people hope to launch. I know the U.S. Has got a new project, the Exploration Initiative, beyond the space station. But Japan and Europe may also have ideas that they would want to attach to the station beyond the current one. So it may be a little bit of a growing village is the way I would describe the space station. So it's hard to say how far it is complete.
There, of course, is, Mike, a possibility that the United States will get out of the International Space Station project in the future. If current plans are approved, that's a high likelihood. Do you find that to be disappointing? And tell me, what do you think the true scope and the use of this space station in the future will be for mankind?
I'd like to build a little bit on my analogy to a small village. I do believe the International Space Station and the project will grow steadily as the years go by, and there will be maybe more or maybe different partners who become the main partners in the International Space Station project. That is not to say that the United States will not drop by and will not visit and will not make use of its already significant investment in the space station. And I think in many ways there will be times when it will be extremely helpful to test equipment that we want to take out of Earth orbit, for example, to the Moon or Mars, and test it at the International Space Station. There may be servicing that we will do better at the International Space Station than trying to do it somewhere else in low Earth orbit. So I don't think we're going to leave the International Space Station for good. It's, as I say, it's a growing town or village, and we will drop by even if we don't become, even if we don't remain the main inhabitants.
In its current configuration, Mike, what is the lifespan of the International Space Station? I mean, how long do you think it can function with current technology? And, of course, where do we look at it in the future? I mean, would we always update it, or would we have to build a brand new one, let's say, in 20 or 30 years?
One, for getting the most out of what you've already put your a lot of sweat and work into. And so I would, building onto this thing and keep adding onto it. And if there are modules that are leaked or modules that are just too dirty and horrible to go into, then we'd seal them off and maybe at some point actually jettison them. But I think the base will remain, and I think we'll be building onto it, adding onto it, moving things around. So I think the life of the station is much longer than the planned life that I think was either 15 years extended to 30.
Of course, so Mike, with the tragedy of the Space Shuttle Columbia and the fact that we are not resuming yet shuttle flights has really, I think, put some pressure now on the Russians to continue to supply the space station and to continue, of course, with its launches. Once the resumption does occur, how much pressure do you think that will take off everybody involved with the ISS?
It'll be significant, but not immediate, though, because there are a number of outstanding construction activities to be resumed on the International Space Station using the space shuttle to launch those heavy, large pieces of equipment that are now waiting at Cape Kennedy, the Kennedy Space Center. Once those are assembled in here, then I think the space shuttle will start to offload significantly the other partners in its ability to carry cargo. But as we understand it, once the space station is assembled, that's when the space shuttle will stop flying. So I'm not sure the relief is really going to be that much felt by our partners.
Alexander, I have always believed that space bridges the gap, I think, between humanity. Of course, there are no politics involved when it comes to an astronaut and a cosmonaut. In your particular case, what's it like working with your counterpart?
I believe that the International Space Station is a very good place for crew. When we are disregarding our political background or our national affiliations, work together when there are no political forces involved in complicating our work, we feel great. This is a very important project and a very important thing that helps us find common ground between the nations for implementation of future projects that have been declared now, Mars Project and Moon Project. It's impossible to go on with the international cooperation unless we manage to work with each other in simpler circumstances. So I believe the International Space Station is a very interesting project and very important and useful work to benefit future projects.
Michael, on Monday, astronomers revealed that they had indeed found what could very well be the 10th planet in the solar system. They call it a planetoid. The marvels, of course, in this universe just continue and continue. Are you at the belief that at least in terms of life out there, maybe like human beings, that it could be out there somewhere?
Well, yes, that is my belief. And I just have to always, if ever I have any doubt, look out the window just as you can on Earth on a clear, starry night. And when you look at the countless stars that are visible, and you think of the likelihoods of planets, which we know are already there from observations by telescopes such as the Hubble, it jumps out at you that it would be the most foolish bet you could ever make that there was no life other than on Earth.
Mike, a number of astronauts in the past had always reported seeing some very strange things, unusual lights, things they really couldn't determine exactly what they might be. Have you or Alexander ever come across anything that you spotted out there that you figured, I have no idea what this is?
Well, yes. Often, initially, I have seen things that have caught my attention, surprised me. Unfortunately, and I say this with regret, because I'm a child at heart and a romantic, I end up finding an explanation for what I've just seen in terms of fitting into my already very broad knowledge of physics and astronomy. For example, the other day I was looking out the window as we crossed Terminator, that's the border between the light side and the dark side of the Earth. It was very beautiful. It's a whole shade of violet, blue colors. And below us, moving past, across the field of view, was this bright flashing object, and it initially looked just like an airplane going into an airport with its lights flashing. And I was thinking, oh, it's an airplane. Oh no, it can't be an airplane because it's about somewhere near us. And I watched it go by very fast, and I thought about it. Now I thought about calling Sasha, but then I thought, no, I know what it is. We're crossing the Terminator. It's probably a piece of debris that's come off. Actually, it couldn't have been debris because it was in the wrong orbit, but it was a lower satellite, I'm pretty sure, that was below us and spinning and reflecting at us as it went by. There are many little events like this, lights that we see in particular outside that initially don't seem really obvious, but after you think about them, you can come up with an explanation.
Well, indeed, Michael, the marvels of the universe. Look, we've got about a minute left, and with 5 to 10 million listeners who think about you and Alexander all the time, we haven't forgotten you. Any final statements to the world?
I just want to say that people should keep looking up at the stars, thinking about where we are on the planet Earth and where we are in the solar system and in the galaxy. We need to fix our problems on Earth, but that should never stop us dreaming and looking beyond the horizon and looking up towards the stars. And I believe the work that the United States in particular has put into this project is extremely worthwhile, not only for the United States, but for the rest of the world. It's a great project to take part in, one we should be proud of. So thank you very much for putting us here.
And thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us here on Coast to Coast. You, Mike Fole, and you, Alexander Kaleri. Thank you.
You're always welcome.
Thank you, George. Nori with Coast to Coast AM. Alpha, we are now resuming operational space-to-ground communication.
That was fun. For Dan Galante, Donna Walker, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Alex Lonehood, Sean Ladasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, and George Knapp, I'm George Nori, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.